Hi, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Barushi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, as you probably know by now, we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a different article, and we invite the author of that article on to talk about what they wrote for the book, and also just their career and their thoughts on interactive writing in general. So it's all about the craft of writing and the people who do it. And this week, we're really excited to have Jill Shah with us. Jill, hi.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Welcome. You're very, very welcome. So firstly, we always start off by just asking if you could sort of introduce yourself and just outline your career to date so far and how you fit into the world of game writing for the benefit of people who have encountered your work, but not necessarily your name.
Yeah. My name is Jill Shah. I'm a writer and narrative designer. I'm currently at a startup called Magic Soup. Before that, I was at a studio called Harebrained Schemes, where I was the lead writer on the Lamplighters League. And before that, I spent 5 years at Bungie working on Destiny and Destiny 2. And before that, I did some freelancing kind of stuff for a couple of mobile games companies. It was called Freeverse. It was called Dragoncraft. probably no one remembers that. It was so long ago. But yeah, that's been my career about 12 years now.
Amazing.
Brilliant. Well, you've had a big and diverse career, which clearly shows in the article that you've written for us. It sounds like you've been on your own sometimes, maybe worked with bigger teams sometimes, and all of that I think comes through in this piece that you've written for us. It's called "You're Not a Bad Writer, You Just Don't Get the Assignment." Jill, please, if you would give us the thesis of the article, summarize it just in case people haven't read it.
Yeah, so I've been on writing teams and then also led writing team on Lamplighters League, and I think every writer knows that writing is really personal, right? You often feel like your self-worth is very tied up to your writing, and everyone also has a unique style that they most prefer to write in. But when you're writing for a project or a team, whether it's big or small, something like Biggest Destiny, or even like a more focused thing like the Lamplighters League. That project also has its own voice and tone assignment. And so I had to learn and then help other folks learn how to look past your own tastes as an individual and figure out what the taste of the project and the lead that you're working on is. So that's what I call getting the assignment, is understanding that it's not about your own personal taste. It's about figuring out what is going to be best for the project.
I love this article, if only because I have fallen into this trap many a thousand times, I feel, and even to my own self.
Yeah.
I feel like it's
all
so easy to kind of lose. Yeah, you just lose the frame of reference of what you're working on, and it can be easy to catch yourself. But, you know, in the book, there are a number of articles that I think are of particular value and interest to people who are not just trying to get into the industry, but who are starting out and trying to avoid maybe some common traps. So I wonder if we can dig into that just a bit more, especially since you've been around the block on this, right? How does it usually manifest that people fall into this trap? Is it, say, for example, that people will over-deliver something, write too much text, kind of go off in their own direction? Is it usually a tonal thing and a voice question? Is it that people aren't waiting and listening and observing first or playing the game enough first? What are the actions that people take that tend to result in this problem?
I think on the writer side, it's always about tone, figuring out what the tone of the project is. But also, you know, you talked about waiting, listening. Sometimes it's also on the other side, it's up to the leads in the project to provide something that you can listen to, you know, so that it's harder to sort of wait and listen and gather information when you're just starting out with a brand new IP at the beginning of the project, right? Like still finding what that voice is. So I think a lot of it is really just trial and error. And then when you're doing that trial and error process, I think the most important thing to just keep your stamina up as a writer is to not take that feedback personally. That if you aren't hitting the tone of the project yet, it's not because you're a bad writer. Like just taking that part out of it and putting that aside and taking the ego out of it and saying, okay, what what can I do to align to the project? It just makes everything easier, less painful on an individual level, right? And helps people get more quickly to a final sort of coherent project.
So obviously when you're in this process of like doing the trial and error and trying to kind of get through iterative loops and take that feedback, do you find that it's advisable or do you yourself, if you're in that stage of the process, do you find that it's worth trying extreme examples of things? Like, do you write the version where, I don't know, the noir character is particularly sort of soft and cozy just to see how it lands with people? Is that a strategy, or do you find it's more sensible to try the kind of median version and very slowly branch out to the fringes? What's your way of approaching that?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that the frustrating answer is that it depends. Unlike a younger team where people are still kind of learning to trust each other, it might be better to go with the kind of the median, like play the tropes, right? Like hit that classic kind of stuff. Whereas if you have trust between the team, between the writers on the team, or between like you and the creative lead, and you want to say like, hey, like hold my beer, I'm going to try something, you know, like that. I think that's a scenario where it feels like safer and easier to try something kind of like the conflicting tones. You're talking about like your example, right? Like a noir story, but with a soft and cozy character, right? Yeah. Like, and there are, it just depends on what the project is or will become, right? Like, I think if we racked our brains, we could think of a story that is a cozy noir, but that is a noir, but with a cozy character. But is that what this project is, that the theoretical one that you're talking about, or is it trying to be more of a, you know, straight up, down the board classic noir character?
Yeah, noir story. Because presumably with every game, you're trying to find the space, right? And then once you've got the space defined, you can start generating the content, and often games require a huge amount of content. So you really need to know the space of it. So do you find that that's, it sounds like what you're saying is that with more experienced teams, you can afford to kind of do that slightly faster, maybe, that you can sort of throw out curveballs to define where are the boundaries of this. Oh, this is too cozy. That's okay. This, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas with younger teams, you have to be a bit more cautious because people don't know what that space feels like when they found it or something like that.
Yeah. And I think so. But I think it's also really just about how individuals are like gelling. And you have to, there's like, there's that stage where people are still feeling each other out and, you know, building up the trust of like, you know, are we communicating on the same wavelength? Are we all sort of on board with this assignment that we're talking about? And I think also it can help when you're doing that kind of experimentation to kind of call your shot at first and say like, listen, I'm going to try something a little weird. Like I know this is the general, you know, this is the sort of collection of tropes that this genre usually encompasses, but I'm going to try something over here. So like, you know, give me a couple days. I'm going to turn this around to you and it's going to feel weird maybe, but see how it hits you. Right. And if you set that up at first and sort of get people prepared for, something, you know, this like the curveball, I think it's often much more well received.
Right. So if you just really establish the, I know where the trope is, I'm not just doing this wrong, I'm trying to kind of find the boundaries of this thing. That's really,
yeah.
So a lot of it comes down to that, the kind of human interrelationships within the team. And it's less about the experience and it's less even about the project itself. It's about kind of how those individuals are gelling.
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do you find as a, you know, when you're coming onto a project as a freelancer, because I imagine you've done freelance work as well as kind of embedded studio work. How do you go about discovering that? Like, how do you get to know? I mean, especially when we're all working remotely and we don't even sit in the same room very much. Like,
yeah.
How on earth can writers coming into environments figure that stuff out without having to just slam into the walls a lot?
It's really tough. I mean, yeah. If there's already established I don't want to say content, you know, there's already stuff there that you can read it more like scripts that people are already like, yes, we like this, or, you know, prequels or anything like that. That's really helpful. If there's not, then I think that starting off, a lot of my characters, I will often start them sort of writing them as if they were this other already established character, but just in my new world. And then I just kind of try to imitate that. Like I've done that with like Jaime Lannister from Game of Thrones, right? This is Jaime Lannister, but in
takes
this,
a no, right? take a known yeah. character. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, but just like call them something else and, yeah. and, you know, they're in this world, not that one, but their sense of humor is still the same. Their hangups, their, you know, fears and wants to some extent, you have to tweak a lot of stuff. Right. But, I think starting from there, like if your assignment is to like write for these characters, like to go back to the lead and say, hey, so I think that this character kind of hits me like a Jaime Lannister type. And this character hits me like a, you know, da 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 da. Like try to use examples that are from these like really known and uncontroversial stories. Right. You know, and like, does that land with you? Does that sound right? I have, just like as a, growing up as a fan and a young writer, I was very into fan fiction. I love writing fan fiction. Mm. And it is a very fun world and community to be part of. And it also really did help hone some of those skills of like getting into someone else's playground and getting into someone else's sandbox and trying to just absorb the, mm-hmm. the sounds and feels around you, right? And so I actually, like, if I'm hiring folks now, I think it's I always like to hear that people have done fan fiction because it means that you are, you know, are capable of jumping into an IP that isn't your own.
That's awesome. So it's kind of like, it's a bit like when artists I think they call it kit bashing, when they just sort of grab little bits of snippet and to lay out a concept art really quickly, but kind of
right,
kit bashing
right, yeah.
with narrative. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I never thought about it like that, but yeah.
It's so funny because I feel like perhaps quite a number of us were aspiring novelists at some point in our, you know, in our childhoods. And I remember always hearing from novelists in like the 90s and 2000s, like you should never, ever write in someone else's universe. Like you should practice the skill of building your own thing. I was told that like so many times, but the exact opposite is true in media where you are relatively often being brought into a team where you are working on a pre-existing notion when you're not doing solo art and inventing something completely whole cloth, it is a different skill like to develop, right? That you have to get right. It's funny. It's like the challenge of what you have to do. What you're describing, Jill, is like there is a difference to some sort of established project in which you might have previous material and you can work with, or something new. And I feel like this technique you've just given us of take a character that you know is deep and well done, that you know as a fan, and see if you can bring them into this world. And that seems like a technique for a project that is fresher, perhaps, or has a less well-established genre, or is intentionally trying to do something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Is that the case? Is it like we have sort of understood genre stuff, and then we have things where we're like trying to innovate narratively in some way or other, and maybe everyone is kind of triangulating a little bit? Like, is it more like this, or is it more like that? Has that been your experience on the projects where it is a little bit less straight down the road?
I think, well, an extra complication with video games is that, you know, like a book or a film or something you do often see more of that kind of mashup of two different genres or character types that are not always associated with each other. But in a video game, there's a whole extra dimension of the gameplay, right? And so that extra, like, curveball that we've been talking about, the sort of the plus that makes your project unique might come from the gameplay, and they actually would want the narrative to be a little bit more straight down the barrel. So I think sometimes, like as a writer, you want to be doing something that feels fresh, but again, it's like, what's the assignment, right? If the assignment is to support the gameplay, and the gameplay is this kind of far out thing, then maybe you kind of need to keep, you know, play the hits as the a narrative person. Yeah. I think something we talk about in game development a lot is that people come to a game with a certain number of expectations, right? Like, is this an FPS or a third person, right? You know, usually these buttons are the shooting buttons and these, you know, things like that. Or I expect to have collectibles or whatever it is, right? And as a designer, you can teach players like a couple new things that are unique to your game. But if you ask them to relearn everything and throw out the whole book, that's too much cognitive weight for most players, right? Like people want to be able to jump in and feel like they understand something very quickly, I think, especially these days. And so you know, just I think it's important to be aware of all the different places where in your game as a whole, you're asking players to go with you against the grain, and just take stock of all of those. And if you feel like the list is getting a little too long, you might have to, as a team, start putting some back, right? And that might mean some of the narrative curveballs, or, you know, it usually will mean narrative over gameplay, right? For being honest, but yeah.
So have you found, I suppose, maybe you found then that, like, while there might be exceptions, more commonly than not, the pitfall is an attempt to go outside of the core tone of the story and to try to sort of pitch something different. That's a more common failure state. Has that been your experience?
Do you mean as an individual or as a project?
Yeah, as an individual writer, like this type of person you're writing this article to.
I mean, yeah, I'm writing the article to, like, yeah, younger folks who are typically joining a larger writing team, where there is, like, presumably a creative director, probably also a narrative lead who has this kind of established, who has a vision to some degree of what they want. And everyone has a different process in terms of, like, coming in with, I know exactly what I want, versus finding it along the way. And that's something else to sort of figure out about the person that you're working with, right? But yeah, I think that I think the most common pitfall for a young writer is to come in with that feeling of, like, oh, I'll do me, right? And you is wonderful, we love you, but for this particular project, if you can put on different hats, you'll become a more valuable team member to that project. I think it what you said before about, like, in the 90s authors, you know, that advice about playing in your own world, I think that is often the difference between, like, you know, some people call it fine art versus commercial art. That's more like, my husband is a concept artist, and he went to an atelier program, so he had some, you know, colleagues who went to the games industry and some colleagues who became fine artists, and both are awesome, like, really valuable artistic and professional paths. And I think if you are going the kind of fine art path, which maybe is also in this analogy like an author, then it's really important to build your own voice above all and learn how to world build from scratch. But if you are a commercial artist, it is a really essential skill to learn how to get other people's assignments.
Okay.
Makes sense. So I love that description that you gave of playing the hits. That kind of really resonated for me. Like, I just sort of, all right, okay, if that's what I need to be doing, then okay, that totally makes sense. So, but obviously to do that on a day-to-day basis, we still have to bring kind of passion and our enjoyment and our enthusiasm and kind of deliver at the highest level we can find.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a project where you're very much playing the hits, let's say, you know, you're writing for Doom 73 or whatever, and everything about this world has been defined, how do you go about looking for the joy? Where do you go to find the joy in writing projects where it's definitely not about innovation, kind of pushing the boundaries? Because, you know, that's a certain kind of creative joy, right? But it's not the only one. So
right.
So where do you find the joy in kind of the playing the hits?
Yeah, I think going back to the source material at first, like, you know, from writing Doom 73, like, I got to play the first 72 Dooms, or maybe the first five or something. And then if I play them and I'm like, I don't get it at all, right? Then I have to seek out the people who do, right? And say, like, tell me what you loved about this. And then just, like, let their enthusiasm be infectious, you know, and figure out how to put yourself in that love for, you know, whatever it is, high energy, gore fights, you know, heroic masculine sacrifice or whatever, right? Like, you know,
whatever,
like,
it is,
make a list of the tropes or whatever it is, and you know, figure out how to become a fan of that.
Like, so you say it so nicely in the article, right? You say sort of the best writing advice you know is to learn how to fall in love with everything, right? Like find something in that works for you. And two different writers could look at the exact same structure, perhaps, and pick out something different and maybe make that the bigger thing that they're trying to do. That really resonated with me from the article.
Oh, thanks. I said it better in writing than I said out loud.
I don't agree. I think I thought that was really interesting what you said, and I wanted to pick up on it and just sort of reflect it back. That idea of sort of instead of kind of becoming a fan of a character in the story or the world of this game that perhaps you don't connect with, if that's the example, then instead you become like, you learn how to write the fan themselves and like learn to understand the fan, and they become your character, and you think, what does this character, okay, I'm imagining a fan now, what do they want to see? And I think that's actually really, I really like that. I think that's really smart.
I think also like people say know your audience, but that can often, like, I struggled with that advice for a while because it's like, what, you know, the audience can feel so amorphous and faceless. But if you pick a single person and you write just like, oh yeah, I know that so-and-so's going to go nuts when they read this, you know, like just one person, right? And then if you find that person and then you write your stuff for that person, you know, that's a really fun feeling.
I think that's brilliant. So I kind of, that ties onto one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, particularly about writing for, I was thinking of Destiny. For writing for a really big, I don't think it's unfair to call it a corporate title, but like certainly a very, very well established title with a really clear sense of what it is and how it works. And I've never worked for a team of that size or that kind of scope. But you get the sense that the writers, the game wants the writers to be sort of invisible and completely smooth. So, you know, that readers can't pick out, players can't pick out who wrote which individual bit. So you've got to have some kind of hive mind gelling thing going on. How on earth do you achieve this? Like within such a visible high stakes environment, like is that the way that writers approach it? Or is that actually not a very good description of what happens?
I think that, in something as expansive as Destiny, not just in terms of the size of the game, but also it kind of spans genres, and it's still recognizably Destiny, and that gives a lot of creative freedom in a sense, because you can say like, okay, you're really good at like, you know, the space western tone, like write these characters and we're going to bring you on board for the missions in this release, and this release now here is going to be more of like a, you know, military sci-fi, so like, you know, so and so has really got the military jargon down, right? And then the next release after that is going to be sort of like a haunted space gothic kind of thing, right? And all three of those genres and more are Destiny, but you have, you know, different tones per release, per DLC, and you can, you know, help different writers kind of find their strengths within the larger umbrella in those kind of subgenres. Another, we for a little while, what we also did is divided up folks by character, so that you were not necessarily writing every line of dialogue by a character, but you would be the sort of point person for a character. So if, you know, because the same character can appear across missions and strikes and raids and all these different types of content. And sometimes it's easier to embed a writer with the team making that kind of content, with the mission design team versus the strike team. So, you know, I would be, if my coworker is like the point person for X character, but I'm embedded in the missions team and I'm writing that character, I would send all my scripts to them to be like, does this sound like so-and-so? And they can, you know, give me notes on that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. So it's actually much less about creating a kind of smooth, amorphous writing blob that can execute anything under any circumstances, much more about finding the individuals and making sure that they're sort of connected up and communicating together to do individual bits of work.
In that case, I think so. Yeah, because overall, the tone of Destiny, like the genre, was so fluid from release to release, which is part of the like identity, which was the assignment for Destiny, right? Like it's part of its sort of strength as an IP. So the thing that we focused the most on was consistency and character voice.
Thinking of your article, absolutely, obviously, one of the audiences that you had in mind is that sort of junior writer who's coming in. But you keep a pretty significant amount of advice also for the the sort of establishment side of that writing team, the lead of the writing team? How should you maybe give advice to that person? How should you take the ego out of the question, like you had mentioned a little bit earlier? And you had said earlier in the call that it is really all about figuring out how you gel with the team. And I wonder if we can turn to that a tiny bit, and if you could talk a bit about what best practices you've seen in establishing a good writing organization. It could be maybe a team as small as three, let's say, but either way, let's say if you're beyond just two people, surely one answer is maybe documentation. Another is simply just interpersonal friendliness, the way you would in any creative group. But yeah, what have you found works across teams, across genres?
Yeah, I wanted to sort of talk to both in the article because I've been both, and I think that it, you know, we're all so busy and life goes by so fast, and we all have these projects that we care so much about that it can very quickly, you can start to forget what it felt like to be the junior writer.
Totally.
And so just wanted to just kind of connect the dots, like in my life of like, hey, this is, you know, how I felt when I was on this side of the table. And so let me try to remember that. Sometimes it's awkward, right? Like, oh, I was so young, but you know, but, you know, try to remember what it felt like and just, have sympathy, I guess, because writing is very personal. And I think writers tend to be sensitive, or at least I am. And of course, so that doesn't necessarily mean tiptoeing around people, but just like naming stuff, right? Like just saying out loud, like, hey, this script wasn't right, but that doesn't mean it wasn't good. Like I enjoyed this script. It just wasn't a script that fits this game, you know? And I think just that language alone just
makes a difference. Yeah.
Saves egos. It helps people put themselves aside and get onto the assignment.
Yeah. Like, so I guess you're saying maybe a big part of establishing the right culture is just feedback on writing, like how you give that feedback, how specific it is, and but certainly what tone it's in. And I think that rings pretty true to me. I feel like I, so often in games, I have felt relatively alone as a writer. Like I'm the only voice in there, and I know that something might have been my first take or my second take, but I haven't had time to do more. And I would welcome, another experienced writer to look at it and to say, please give me something to work with. I don't know if that's been sort of a feeling that you've ever felt, that the sense that like you can produce something, but one of the joys of working in games writing is this chance that you're kind of co-creating with a team of other people.
And that's part of the whole shebang, right? Is that you're working with a team and not just, on your own specific project. And so if that's what you sign up for, like that's, you know, hopefully you love that dynamic.
Something you said actually did give me something to think about. I wonder if maybe we can move the conversation this way. And that is, there are junior writers, but it is also not uncommon to have where a writing team says, hey, we're going to do that big gothic horror DLC or content drop or something. None of us are a real specialist here. We'd like to bring on someone who we know is uniquely talented in this thing. We have a stable of people in mind or a particular person in mind, but they're not coming on as a junior. They're sort of coming on for a voice. Have you had that experience ever? And if so, does this still apply there, or how would you adjust?
I haven't had that experience. And I think it's because often, and this is also, I think, was in the back of my mind with the article, oftentimes creative directors of games aren't themselves coming from a writing background. And so I think sometimes like that sort of like genre savviness or identifying, oh, this is, you know, this is a different type of voice, and therefore there might be a different kind of, you know, writer who is, who takes to this more easily. I don't think that's always in the vocabulary of game developers. But more so than that, even, I think that budgets are the, you know, supreme overlord of us all, and it's not always in the budget to bring an outside, bring a new writer onto a project. It's more, you know, you have your team, and the task becomes helping the team figure out, you know, get onto the voice that you want for your release.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've seen on a lot of projects and from a lot of people, this sense that oftentimes people across the team don't really necessarily understand writing. And historically anyway, like 10 years ago when I was more in the studio culture, people didn't really understand that it could be good or bad. They would sort of expect writing to just work. They would say, well, write this thing, and then you produce the thing, and they go, that's not the thing, you haven't done the job. And there's this sort of weird gap where people don't really understand that there can be rounds of feedback and review, that like obviously yeah. artists do it all the time and everybody's yeah. used to that idea, but somehow with writing it sort of either it works and it's brilliant or it doesn't work.
Or we have a bad writer.
We have a bad writer, we need to get rid of this person. You're like, no, you just need to tell me what you want, because you haven't told me what you want. Like in general, do we have a sense that like people are understanding that better? Like I feel like narrative in games is getting better on in a kind of year by year basis. Like do directors understand this more? Like do game developers understand this more, or are writers just toughening up and getting through it better?
Ah, such a good question. I don't know. I think that, well, at least for me, I think it's about communicating expectations. That's the thing that's been most successful for me. And so then, so just identifying for people who aren't in your particular discipline, like, you know, hey, when an artist does a sketch before they do the final piece, you can tell that it's a sketch. Like anyone can tell that it's a sketch, but how do you tell the difference between a rough draft and a final draft other than that the writer says this is the final draft, right? I mean, if you know the writer, then you could be like, okay, but it's much, much harder to identify that. And so just like establishing the expectations of like, this is a rough draft. You know, there's no character voices here. It's just there's no subtext. It's just the text of the plot and the information that the characters need to convey. Like if you sort of preface that or whatever it is, whatever your take on a first draft is, I think that priming people for that expectation always makes things better. One time on Destiny release, which was really successful internally, the first kind of round of the campaign, we used temp dialogue and didn't try to do any dialogue at all. I say dialogue, but it was really just narration. We got a designer with a really cool voice, and we had him read the, like, you know, you land on the planet and so and so comes on the comm and says this, and that makes you feel angry, but you decide to da da da, right? And so we didn't even try to get into the, you know, the voices of the characters. It was just plot and emotion.
Like, yeah, Dungeon Master second person almost.
Right.
Style
well, and even then,
this, right?
We got a lot of people in the studio who were like, wait, are we doing like a Bastion style narrator
yeah, you
thing
get
now?
This question.
Like, no.
yeah. It's almost just, like this. It's, yeah. it's for this exact reason. It's because like people just don't, they'll see this and they'll be like, and then they might not trust, like, can you make it better? Is it possible? And so I better put in the feedback now, because if no one says anything, then what if this just gets into the beta build or something?
You know, right.
It snowballs. Yeah.
So communication up front, like this is what it's going to be. This is what it's not going to be. I think that helps a lot.
Yeah, it's so difficult though, isn't it? It's like artists talk a lot about grey boxing their environments, right. And they always say that the reason we grey box it is because nobody can mistake it for a final asset.
Right.
But like, how do you grey box writing short of just writing blah 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 in the middle of every sentence? I actually have no idea.
That was our attempt to grey box writing, right? And then even then, it's like, oh, narrator.
You did too good a job though. It was too slick.
What's this meta fictional thing you're doing? You know what other department I think has this challenge is audio. Whether we put in Scratch or whether you put in like nothing, or you put a computer voice. If you're doing a sci-fi story, like, people sometimes cannot tell like what the difference is. And so they're sort of like, well, are you going to have another performance? And the truth is, it might depend on your budget. You might not know. Will you have another one? That is the whole point of doing work in layers, of course, right? That like, you might not have time to update every single thing from text to subtext. You might have to leave some things in at that light level.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's game development, I guess.
Yeah. Especially when there's a case where it's like, you know, this mechanic or this scenario in the mission or whatever, we don't have time to do that, like to polish that up to a point where it becomes totally intuitive to the player or anything like that, right? And so, you know, like narrative is sometimes there to give the helping hand of like, you know, try shooting the spider web or whatever, right? Like people laugh at those lines, but sometimes that is, you know, a type of line that people will pluck out to laugh at it on its own, but together they make the game successful as a whole.
We had Ian Thomas on a little while ago, and he pointed out that he's like, it is very often helpful to have more narrative VO, let's say, early in a project, and then you strip it out later because the rest of the departments have caught up. Because it's cheaper to sort of just say, and now right in front of you is a door to heaven. And then the artist will just display the door to heaven and you don't need to say it anymore, right? And right. It's kind of stuck with me that we have a role to play here. And I guess you're saying, like, if you prime the team, if you're like really communicative with them, it raises the question to me of, well, we've talked, I suppose, for much of the call of like what it's like to be the junior writer doing this, but being the lead of narrative or the lead writer, what tools do we have to do that communication with, let's say, a larger team so that they know what they need to know? They know the most important beats, especially if the project is new or it's not just a sequel or a DLC. Surely reference is really important if you're sort of building it from scratch. Like, what have you made use of to keep people on the same page and keep it all coherent?
Yeah. I mean, references are a big one because none of us create in a vacuum. But even that, you said something earlier about, like, you know, even the same character or the same trope or the same moment, two people could love different things about it.
Yeah.
And so that's often, like, you know, you'll say, like, you know, this character is like Darth Vader or whatever. Right? And like, but what you love about Darth Vader is like, yes, the tender father side of him under the mask. And what I love about Darth Vader is how terrifying and evil he is, right? Yeah. Like, and so, you know, this breaking down the thought process of, it's just saying more than that, right? It's not just enough to say like this character or like this scene or this film, but like, you know, in what ways, what are you connecting to and what aspect of it are you, you know, hoping to see recreated? I think also making, it's always easier to, make more of a thing that already exists instead of starting from a blank page. And so if you're able to, as a creative, to write a couple of scripts or even, you know, put together like a, you know, a tone reel, I think that is really helpful. That isn't always available because, like, you know, like we mentioned earlier, not every creative director or, you know, lead on a project comes from a writing background. And that's kind of the magic of video games. We have so many different disciplines and then we come up to, you know, this, it all kind of has to come back through the small handful of people. And it's just not possible for every person on that team to have a background in every single creative field that goes into video games. So if you're not, you know, from that writing background, then just, I think for me, trying to communicate not just what you love, but why you love it. And that helps people get onto the same page and make sure that you're all talking about the exact same thing, even though you're using the same words.
So again, it's that idea of having the trust between the team and having trust, people understand like that the work that people are doing is perhaps experimental or exploratory, and it's not kind of the limit of their ability, even though they're costing the company money on a day-by-day basis and maybe not finishing the asset today. Yeah, this is so important to actually getting to the other end of the project. That's really clearly put, I think. I had one question, which is sort of, we're coming towards the end of our time, so I wanted to ask one provocative question, which is totally unfair, but it just occurred to me when I was reading your article. So your article says, you know, if the thing you write doesn't land or the scene you write doesn't really work with the game director, it's not because you're a bad writer, it's because you don't get the assignment. And I love that piece of advice. What if you are a bad writer? Like, because when we start off in the industry, when we're young, realistically, we're not good writers necessarily. We're figuring it out, we're getting better on a day-by-day basis, but I think sometimes it can feel very difficult for young people because they have to walk into a studio environment and be amazing for anyone to take them seriously. And, you know, realistically, when we started, I don't think any of us were amazing, but we were kind of willing to try. So how do you partly as a lead, how do you give the feedback when the feedback isn't you've misunderstood the assignment, it's this just isn't actually good enough and you need to do it again? Like, how do you make that land okay? And as a young person, how do you differentiate between those two things? Like, how do we peel those apart so that people can get better, so that we can make better writers out of not so good writers?
Yeah, that is a tough question. There's lots of different sort of layers and angles and approaches to it. I mean, I think on a bigger writing team, there has been an interview process. So like, you know, theoretically that as filtering for some level of like talent and potential. And then once you're through the interview process, like, I think it is just healthiest to assume talent and competence from all your coworkers, sort of unless proven otherwise. And so like starting from that, that's kind of where part of what I was wanted to say in the article is just like start from that assumption, right? If it's not the case, then that is maybe I think that's not just a narrative question. That is something that some, you know, various teams have had to figure out with you know, individuals over the course of a course of different projects. But I still think that framing it as with the focus on skills and skill building, as opposed to like the person themselves and their qualities, talking about the qualities of the work, not the qualities of the person. It just helps everyone get on board with the discussion, because we're sensitive people, you know, and no one wants to feel like they're doing badly. And so, giving feedback in such a way that hurts someone's feelings is counterintuitive to the goal of making the project better. And I'm not saying tiptoe around people. Like, you have to be able to tell the truth and be honest and also receive feedback in a way that is, you know, that has grace, and to build up some calluses on that kind of thing. But it's a little bit of just shaping keeping the focus of the conversation on the work and not the person helps everybody.
Think even in a very kind of practical, hands-on, like, here's a line, let's make it better. Here's a section, let's make it better. And I very much like what you said about sort of assuming that everyone is good, talented, competent, full of interesting things to say, ready, and then helping them kind of get there if they're not there. That seems like a really kind of constructing that sort of supportive environment. Thank you.
It does strike me that you have something almost always in game development, which is that it is very difficult for people to have completely randomly ended up on a writing team, the narrative jobs being the sort of least numerous of the typical jobs, right? So if you've arrived, it is almost certain that you are interested at least in narrative to some degree, right? If you made it through an interview process, you come in, and you can almost always work with that, right? Like, you can almost always work with like genuine interest in a thing. Someone can try something and you can keep working with them, because there will then be some intrinsic desire in that person to get better. And then your advice, Jill, is even more important to if they sort of suspect or know that they might be weak, for to not raise their hackles up and damage the process of improvement to begin with. But I think what is almost insurmountable is to have to work with sort of disinterest or cynicism. I think that is really hard. I think sometimes it manifests as like a real concern and protectiveness that leads to a lack of vulnerability. And if you're unable to be vulnerable in your writing, I think it's very hard to be a good writer. But yeah, to me, I don't know. That's just my take. I'm curious if that has been your experience. If those barriers, those sort of barriers of like whether someone is willing to sort of give themselves to the work, that you can't fix as a manager for them, I imagine.
Right. I mean, yeah. I've called writers sensitive a couple times now as a pejorative, slightly using myself as the main example. But it's not always a bad thing, right? Like, I think it is. You know, I do think that. The same sensitivity that can sometimes make it, you know, awkward to give feedback to someone is also part of a trait that can be conducive to understanding other people, getting into the mindset of other characters, understanding what excites the minds of fans who are fans of things that maybe you're not a fan of, right? It's that empathy and sensitivity are linked and are really important. Trait, I think, to the writing craft. To a lot of creative crafts, yeah.
Yeah, to that process of kind of finding the truth, whatever the truth is that you're trying to express. Yeah, I kind of love that. Like, I think it's funny, we often talk about craft in quite a logical way. People are very much, this line is too long, or the rhythm is wrong, or the beat doesn't, or the information isn't quite accurate. But at the same time, obviously, we have to write a lot by feel, and I think it's important to recognize that and kind of respect it, actually, as a thing that people are putting out there when they're doing it. So it's nice to hear that, to sort of think about both of those sides of how people do that work.
It's so hard to keep all of those things in mind at the same time, juggle all of it, right? Like I think that's where all the multiple drafts comes in. Like Robert McKee is like the teacher, the story screenwriting teacher, always, I think he says something like, you have to write 10 drafts to make one good draft. I'm paraphrasing horribly, I'm sure. But like, so even someone who's like an expert at all that, you know, the technical stuff that you just mentioned, getting the information across and the pacing and the length of the line and all of that, there's still this like trial and error feelings, emotions process that does often take a lot of drafts to get to the page, to get in front of people. It's hard.
Yeah, this is a very good point. It is hard. And it's a good reminder for us all to have. Jill, I think we might close things up about there. This has been a blast to talk to you about a topic that's, I think, quite relevant for so many people, but also sometimes difficult and tough to talk around. And that advice that you have, that that if you sort of focus on the task at hand and not just yourself or expectations, and you just try to see if you can find that alignment, that is a pretty resonant piece of advice. So thank you so much for giving it and for coming here to chat with us today. For the rest of our listeners, thank you so much for listening to this episode. We will have another episode for you next week as we interview someone else who has contributed to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope, and we'll have some extra chatter to have about their topic. So thank you very, very much for today, and we will see you next time around. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.